I think there's been a long-standing debate between the political people, and not just around Biden, but in the Democratic Party generally, and the economic policy staffs. The economic policy staffs have basically been saying for years, look, Mr. President, we've got a good story to tell here on jobs, on inequality, rising wages for poor people. But the political people, I think, they just look at the polls and they say, look, Biden's approval rating on the economy, as you say, is 40%. So their advice has been, I think, to steer away from that if you can. I think that sort of argument seemed to win out earlier in the year, and Biden was very much emphasizing the sort of non-economic arguments, but he seems to have flipped a bit in the last few weeks.
That's my colleague, John Cassidy. John has been tracking the Biden administration's economic strategy since the beginning.
Now our economy is literally the envy of the world.
And to hear President Biden talk about it, you'd think that Americans would be celebrating in the streets.
15 million new jobs in just 3 years. A record.
But if you look at the polls, while Americans might be feeling slightly better about the economy, they aren't actually giving Biden that much credit. Should they be? And what exactly is Biden's plan? You're listening to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, and I'm a senior editor at The New Yorker. So, John, I wanted to start with a really basic question, which is basically how we measure whether the economy is doing well or doing poorly. What are the main measures that economists use, and then what are the measures that voters use, and are they different?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. There's a whole variety of economic statistics which economists and policymakers look at. The most basic one is GDP, which is a measure of all the output of the economy. If GDP is high, it generally means the economy is doing well. The other most obvious one is the unemployment rate. People care a lot about jobs, so obviously the number of jobs and the number of people who are out of work is an enormous one. The general public do look at those, but what we've found over the last few years is that the general public also look very closely at the cost of living, basically the rate of inflation, consumer prices, which for decades really nobody looked at that closely because we've had this incredible period since the early 1990s of low inflation, prices rising so slowly that most people didn't even notice them rising very much. What happened then was during the pandemic, there was this great supply shock. Prices of virtually everything, particularly goods, went up very rapidly. And that came as a huge shock to people, and their wages weren't rising nearly as rapidly. And basically, for the last 4 years, we've been dealing with the economic aftermath of that shock.
So it seemed like about a year ago, a lot of economists believed that we were headed for a recession. You've written about this a lot. The recession didn't happen, and I know that the reasons why it didn't happen are, you know, heavily subject to debate, but what's your best explanation for why we were able to avoid it?
Again, that's another good question. You have to go back to why most economists thought that there was going to be a recession. It was basically due with interest rates. Again, we had a very long period of very low interest rates. Mortgage rates were down to 2.5%, you'll remember, before the pandemic. What happened is when inflation rose, the Federal Reserve, which has a mandate to keep stable prices and maximize employment, decided to raise interest rates. It held off for a while and got a lot of criticism for that, but eventually it decided to act pretty dramatically. And it raised interest rates from virtually zero to over 5% by the middle of last year. And if you just use standard economic models, which you see in the textbooks, most people would expect that to produce a recession because interest rates rise. It's more expensive for people to borrow. It would usually produce a shock in the housing market and would knock the economy into a recession, a mild one maybe, but some sort of recession. That didn't happen this time for a number of reasons, which economists are still debating. One very important one is that the housing market never cracked. Even though mortgage rates have gone from like 2%, 2.5% to 8%, I think they're about 7% now. House prices have kept going up, which is sort of unprecedented, really. And a lot of people's wealth is tied up in their houses. So as long as their house price is still going up, people tend to feel that they're relatively well off. That's helped prop up spending. Also, businesses, it turns out, a lot of them had locked in very low interest rate loans during the early years of the pandemic or even below. So when interest rates went up, it didn't affect their borrowing very much because, as I say, they were already locked in. So we didn't see the sort of feed through to businesses having a sort of cost shock and laying off people either. So the net impact of it all has been basically that higher interest rates haven't hit the economy nearly as hard as most economists expected.
So what else are we seeing with the economy right now, just going back to those measures that we use to kind of figure out whether the economy is doing well, like inflation, you know, unemployment? Where would you say that we're at?
Well, I mean, I think you have to take them in terms. I mean, the great news about the economy over the last few years has been the employment story. For decades, economists thought the unemployment rate had to be sort of 5 or 6% to keep inflation low. This time, we've taken unemployment rate down to the threes. For 2 years now, it's been under 4%. And that hasn't led to higher inflation, but it's had a lot of very beneficial impacts in other ways. Obviously, when there's low unemployment rate, it means that, you know, there's a plentiful jobs. And what we've found is that when you take unemployment rate down to a very low rate, employers have to pay higher wages, even to people who in the past they were able to pay very low wages. So the big beneficiaries of the low unemployment era have been low-paid workers, non-college workers, even high school graduates, who I'm sure you know have been the big sort of victims of the last 40 years, for basically since the early 1970s, they're this section of the workforce who've seen their wages stagnate and in a lot of cases even fall in real terms. What's happened since 2020 is that actually their wages have gone up faster than the rest of the workforce. So we've seen this incredible reversal in wage inequality. So that's the great news, and that's an unemployment story. Inflation, you asked about as well. Well, of course, that's an enormous story. That's the flip side to what's happened, and I think is the reason why Biden's ratings haven't risen. Even though the rate of inflation has come down very sharply, it was up to like 9% in the summer of 2022, and I think it's down to close to 3% now. There were some figures this morning, it's gone up slightly, but it's basically running close to 3%. Reduction in inflation, you know, that's good news, but the regular consumer who goes to the supermarket or whatever doesn't see that very much because the rate of prices going up has fallen doesn't mean actual prices are falling in absolute terms. If you look at things like eggs, fuel oil, price of cars, chicken, they've all still considerably higher than they were in 2020, even though they've fallen in some cases sharply over the last year or so. So I think that's one reason why the sort of improving economy and the fallen inflation hasn't fed through, you know, to Biden's poll ratings. There's also, I think, a lag involved here in that it's taken a long time for people to even realize that inflation is falling. And we're now seeing that, actually. If you look at, there's a sort of big disjuncture now between what people call the economic sentiment indexes, which is how do you feel about the economy? How is your family doing relative to a year ago? Those numbers have actually gone up quite a lot over the last few months, but they haven't yet fed through to Biden's ratings. That may just be a lag, or that's the big question over the next 6 months, whether they do feed through.
We definitely want to get into why these positive developments haven't affected Biden's approval rating yet. But first, I just want to talk a little bit more about how much we can kind of attribute these positive economic developments to Bidenomics.
Well, I think you can certainly attribute some of them. I mean, whoever's the president, they always get too much credit when the economy is doing well and too much blame when it's doing badly. It's always a combination of factors. Obviously, the White House doesn't run monetary policy, so Federal Reserve is, you know, partly responsible for what happens. But the level of demand in the economy and fiscal policy and things like that do matter. And I think there's a consistent story here that Biden's policies, which have been very expansionary from a fiscal point of view, you know, we had the big stimulus program at the start of his presidency, where the American Rescue Act, which was a $1.9 trillion program. Then there were a whole series of more sort of structural reforms, the infrastructure bill, the CHIPS Act, and the Inflation Reduction Act, which was really another sort of spending program largely. They've certainly helped prop up the economy in the last few years. I think when historians look back, the big change in Bidenomics will be the industrial policy, the attempt to stimulate manufacturing in the United States, particularly semiconductors, but all sorts of manufacturing. To some extent, that was a reaction to Trump and his economic nationalism. But Trump talked about doing a lot of this stuff, but didn't actually do much in the end. I mean, if you just look at manufacturing construction, it went up 60% last year, which we haven't seen that since the immediate post-war years.
To what extent would you say that Biden's strategy when it comes to the economy is innovative?
Well, some of it's not innovative. I mean, you know, infrastructure bills for decades were bipartisan affairs. I mean, What's innovative is that he managed to get it through, because Trump had obviously a promise for 4 years to do an infrastructure bill and never did anything. And, you know, you just have to drive around the country to see the decaying roads and bridges and railways, etc. It's been obvious for decades that the US is underinvesting in public infrastructure. The innovative side of the policy has been much more on the industrial policy side, particularly the big spur to green manufacturing. If you remember back to the start of the Biden administration, there were lots of discussions of the Green New Deal. Lots of those pros were originally put into the Build Back Better Act. Build Back Better Act was Biden's original big proposal. That went down when Joe Manchin and Sinema refused to back it. So it seemed for the start of 2022, Biden's economic package had basically been killed. But then in the summer, he agreed a deal with Manchin and rescued large parts of it, especially the green parts of it, in the Inflation Reduction Act. And that included about $400 billion over 10 years for investments in subsidies, basically, for green energy producers, wind, solar, hydropower, and purchases of electric vehicles, retrofitting buildings to make them more energy efficient, etc. On an individual basis, you say, well, they're pretty obvious policies, but we never managed to get them through before.
So thinking about the Inflation Reduction Act, it was supposed to expand tax credits for Americans buying electric vehicles, but then it turns out that it's actually hard for electric vehicle manufacturers to qualify for inclusion. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about how the Biden administration has responded when proposals that look really good on paper just can't be implemented in a clean way.
Well, I don't say they're not implemented in a clean way. I mean, the big issue with electric vehicles has been the batteries. The United States just didn't have the capacity to build batteries for a long time. The detailed sort of regulations on this only went into effect at the start of this year. A lot of Tesla vehicles, for example, are not eligible now for the 7,500 credit because they're still building their batteries abroad. The problem with it so far, I don't think, has so much been the foreign content. It's just that so far, the market for electric vehicles is not as big as people expected. And I think that's largely to do with the fact that the rest of the infrastructure isn't in place. People are still worried that, you know, that you're going to do 300 miles and you're going to break down on the freeways. So the Biden plan does have a lot of subsidies for people to build national charging networks. Tesla's doing that. In fact, conceivable Tesla could end up mainly as a recharging company. But again, that's going to take a while to go into effect. So what you see is Ford and General Motors at the moment are actually cutting back on their electric vehicle plans because they haven't sold as many as they expected. But over the long term, we still are headed for electrification. You can see it in other countries, especially China. The majority of vehicles sold are now electric vehicles because they have the infrastructure in place. So, again, it's a case of the U.S. trying to catch up.
Can you talk about how progressives are responding to Biden's policies, like the child tax credit, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. Generally speaking, I mean, obviously, there are a lot of progressives who are angry at Biden for various things, particularly Gaza now. But on the economic side, I think he basically has carried most of the progressives with him. Largely because, as you said, the child tax credit was a really biggest anti-poverty program we've seen since the 1960s and had a very dramatic impact on child poverty. People have been talking about introducing child allowances, as they call them, in the UK for 50 years. In other parts of the world, it's a sort of commonly accepted policy that you don't want kids growing up in poverty, so you give their parents cash, basically, on a universal basis. And so it's popular. If you just give it to poor people, the political support tends to decline. So what other countries have found is that it's better to do it on a universal basis. The Biden plan originally sort of did that, not completely universally, but the phase-outs were at a pretty high level, so the vast majority of families were eligible for it. Some studies say it reduced child poverty in sort of 21, 22 by 50%. But of course, it's very expensive, and they only put it in, for a year or two. It then lapsed. Biden, in his budget proposal, which came out earlier this week, is proposing to reinstate it, but again, only for a year, because it is a big, expensive proposal. But I think certainly the progressives I interview and talk with saw that anti-poverty program was a big deal. And Biden's also proposed some other sort of big expansions to the social safety net, including universal preschool, child care programs for people who earn under $100,000 a year, programs to subsidize long-term care for the elderly. These are all big progressive programs that progressives have supported for decades, and Biden's He hasn't introduced them all, of course, but I think he's taken them further than any other previous president.
Yeah, I mean, even what he's done with student loan debt. You couldn't cancel it entirely, but I mean, even what he did seemed like it was a huge step forward.
It's certainly bigger than anything that's been done previously. Again, a lot of progressives on that one think he didn't go far enough. But as you say, compared to what's been done previously, it was a big deal. And the people who received the cancellations, I'm sure, are very grateful.
So, John, I'd like to get your take on Biden's State of the Union speech. But first, we're going to take a quick break. You'll hear more of the political scene from The New Yorker in just a moment. If you've been enjoying the show, please leave us a rating and review on the podcast platform of your choice. And while you're there, don't forget to hit the follow button so you never miss an episode.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
John, prior to the State of the Union address, you wrote a piece laying out how you thought Biden should promote his economic achievements and his future goals in the speech. Now that you've watched the State of the Union, I'm wondering how you think he did.
Well, he didn't use any of my particular lines, I don't think. I had one about the U.S. winning the gold medal in recovering from the pandemic, which I thought he might steal, but he didn't, so that was okay. But the general line was the same. I mean, he put a lot of emphasis on the economic recovery from the pandemic. Biden's basic pitch is, look, when I took over, we were still in the pandemic. The country was still in a crisis. I've got us through it. It's been a tough time, but a lot of the policies I introduced are now starting to kick in favorably, and we need to sort of finish the job. That's his basic message. And I think that, you know, it was the right thing to do. If you remember when Biden launched his re-election campaign earlier in the year, the initial emphasis was all on Trump and the dangers of democracy. That's obviously a huge issue and needs highlighting. But it's an issue which tends to play with Democrats rather than with swing voters. You know, if you just look at the opinion polls and ask voters what they think the biggest issues are, the economy still ranks right at the top. So I think any president running for re-election has to center his message on the economic, his economic record and what he plans to do in the second term. And I think the State of the Union was basically an attempt to sort of pivot in that direction. Obviously, he didn't make the pro-democracy argument again and lots of warnings about Trump, but it was accompanied with a big economic focus. And I think that was the right thing to do.
So one of the negative things that Biden pointed out during his speech last week is that inflation still needs to come down. The Fed just published its monthly inflation report, which shows that it's actually risen a bit, indicating that it's going to take some time for inflation to return to normal. What are the main reasons for that?
There are two sides to the inflation picture. Number one was the big increase in the price of goods, that stuff, all the stuff we import from China, clothes, car components, electronics, etc. During the pandemic, because of the supply chain issues, the prices of all these things went up enormously. Over the last couple of years, that's basically all gone away. The supply chain crisis, partly due to Biden's policies and partly just due to the pandemic receding, shipping fees, etc., have gone back down to where they were roughly. So that side of inflation has basically gone away. But what happened is some particular things, food particularly, partly to do with the avian flu, but partly to do with companies not passing along cost reductions and making higher profits. And also some service prices have gone up because wages have risen quite a lot. So companies like fast food chains have seen their wages go up, and you see that reflected in higher prices of fast food, etc., takeout, food of all descriptions is a lot more expensive than it was. So the basic story is you've done the easy part of getting inflation down. As I said, it's come all the way down from nearly 9% to 3%. But the Fed has this arbitrary target of 2%, and getting from 3% to 2% looks like it's going to be pretty difficult and pretty prolonged. And that's why there's this whole debate about whether the Fed is going to cut interest rates this year or whether it's going to keep them where they are.
It almost feels like weight loss or something, where it's like easier to lose the first 50 pounds than it is to lose the last five.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a very, very good analogy. I mean, again, there's a sort of, it's a very complicated debate. There's some statistical issues involved. One of the prices that hasn't come down much at all, in fact, it's still going up, is, as measured by the government, are rents of apartments. But if you look at the prices of new rentals on the market, they have actually have gone down a bit. The statisticians keep saying, well, it's going to feed through into the official prices after a few months, but we've been waiting for a year or so now and it hasn't fed through. It's conceivable it could feed through in the next few months, which would bring the headline figure down towards 2%. That's what the inflation doves are saying. The inflation hawks are saying, no, it's not true. Some prices are actually starting to go back up. The Fed needs to actually have a big rethink here. It's a bit early to say who's right on that one.
So another thing that Biden talked about in the State of the Union was the increase in manufacturing jobs here in the U.S. and more jobs for infrastructure projects like building bridges and highways. We talked a little bit about this earlier, but in what ways are we seeing the impact of those kinds of things right now?
Well, I think the number of manufacturing jobs in the economy has gone up about 800,000 since Biden took office, which manufacturing jobs have been declining for decades. So relative to the number left, that's actually quite a big increase. It did start a bit before Biden took office. This sort of whole reshoring movement has been going on slowly since about 2015. But Biden's policies have definitely accelerated it significantly. I actually thought Biden could have made even more of that in the State of the Union speech. I think the White House is still a bit wary about trying to tell people that the economy is great when people are telling the pollsters it's not great at all. So there's a big political debate in the White House about, you know, how do you deal with that sort of disconnect?
After the break, why voters aren't feeling as good about the economy as Joe Biden is. If you have thoughts or questions about today's episode, send us an email or voice memo to themail@newyorker.com. Be sure to put the political scene in the subject line.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
As we've discussed, only 40% of Americans think Biden is doing a good job on the economy, which seems at odds with the economic achievements that we've been talking about this whole podcast, and also the fact that Americans are starting to feel a little bit better about the economy. I'm just curious what you think some of the reasons are behind this cognitive dissonance among voters.
Well, my basic view on this is that it's just a cost of living story, that people are still reacting to the big increase in the cost of the living we saw during and after the pandemic. And the reason I think that is because it's not just an American story. If American people, consumers, were reacting different to the rest of the world, I think you'd have to look for some specific things based on policy or Biden or whatever. But you don't have to look at that. If you look all around the world, you look at the UK, which has got a centre-right government, it's in terrible shape. It's never had lower ratings. And a lot of that goes back to the higher inflation and higher cost of living. You look in Germany, they have a big centre-left government, which is similarly, you know, in terrible shape. Its poll ratings are awful. And again, that goes back to higher inflation. So it just turns out that high inflation is very, very damaging for democratic governments. I mean, Jimmy Carter obviously learned that in the 1970s when inflation was a lot higher than it's been now. But I think what we've rediscovered in the last few years is that for any democratic government, whether they're center-right, center-left, Biden's obviously center-left, when you get a big cost shock like this, it's just very, very difficult to deal with it politically. And all governments are, you know, sort of struggling to do that. The question then becomes, how long does that last? as you say, when people start to feel better about the economy, which they are doing, poll after poll shows that people think the economy at large is doing better and that their personal finances are improved. Still not up to 50%, but there's a Wall Street Journal poll last week where it had gone from, like, I think 35 to 43% in 2 months, which is a big change. When will that filter through to Biden's poll ratings? You know, you have to look very closely at the ratings to see much change. That it's gone up a tiny bit in the last couple of months, but according to some economic polls, but it's very much poll by poll. There certainly hasn't been the big feed-through that the Biden needs, really, in the next few months.
I'm interested in a certain kind of high price that Biden mentioned during the State of the Union, which is price gouging and junk fees. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the Bidenomics approach to that.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to, you know, quite a few people around Biden about that. And actually, in the early stages of the pandemic, there was an argument in the White House to focus more on that at the time, because one of the sort of strange things that happened, not that strange in retrospect, but it seemed strange at the time, is that profit margins went up a lot very early in the pandemic. Basically, companies saw the prices of their inputs going up a lot, but they increased prices more than proportionately and increased their profit margins, which you wouldn't think they'd be able to do in a down economy. But it worked. I mean, you just have to look at the profit margins of the corporations in general, especially packaged good companies, or listen to the chief executives talking on their earnings calls. And they talk about this all the time, how they've been able to offset their cost increases with higher prices and maintain their profit margins. So there was an argument in the White House, should we criticize the corporations at the time and, you know, tell them to pass along cost reductions when inflation started to fall? There was even, I think, some discussion of whether there should be sort of profit surtaxes. Remember, the price of oil went right through the roof. The oil companies, the energy companies made record profits. Other countries, including the UK, introduced surtaxes, basically like wartime, because it was sort of wartime in the pandemic.
Yeah.
It was like a wartime economy, and in wartime you tend to have surtaxes on profits. The UK went that direction. Biden himself, I think, you know, is a sort of centrist at heart and wasn't willing to do that. I think what you've seen in the last year or so is he's sort of bored into those arguments a bit more. Not so much on the profit side, but you hear him talking about shrinkflation all the time,
yeah,
about how companies are reducing the size of various things, which, you know, is a fact. So you hear him talking about that. And then junk fees. I mean, I've always been amazed in the US that that's not been a bigger issue. The prices of things like credit card overdrafts, missing a payment by one day and being charged $40. That has always seemed to me to be low-hanging fruit for a sort of center-left party. But the Democrats, for whatever reason, maybe they were captured, whatever, they didn't go in that direction, despite some people in the party advocating it. And I think what you're seeing is that Biden is now sort of going in that direction. He's not going to get him much praise from economists or the Chamber of Commerce, but I actually think it could be pretty popular because there are all sorts of junk fees out there, things like airlines charging families to sit together, et cetera, you know.
Yeah, or like you see the price on, you know, Google Flights and then you click on the flight and then when you actually are putting your credit card information in, it, you know, goes up by like $400. I mean, I felt right. Like in the State of the Union, the part where he was talking about like getting a Snickers bar and it looks like it's right. Already half eaten or something, that was actually really effective because it's kind of speaking to the feeling that a lot of people have, which is that, you know, they're getting screwed.
Yeah, well, I know. I think, I mean, like I say, I think, you know, that, as I say, that's as, in other countries, that's been low-hanging fruit for a long time for sort of for political parties, not even on the, even in the Conservative Party in Britain, even as a sort of talked about this, although they don't do much about it. You know, people do get angrier at companies and corporations. It is pretty amazing that we've been through this enormous economic crisis over the last few years and corporations have made bigger profits than ever before. And I think, you know, that's a legitimate topic for Biden to discuss and all the ramifications of it. It's taken him a long time to get there, but he is finally there, it seems.
During the State of the Union, it seems like there was like an interesting self-awareness to the way that he was speaking. I mean, it kind of seemed like he was essentially saying, you know, I'm aware that not everyone is feeling these good effects of low unemployment and higher wages. And so here's some other things that I'm looking at. I'm wondering if you have a sense of what the White House thinks about people not necessarily feeling good about the economy right now? Like, do you think that they understand that they have a clear messaging problem here, or?
Well, I think there's a debate. I mean, there's been a longstanding debate between the sort of political people, and not just around Biden, but in the Democratic Party generally, and the economic sort of policy staffs. The economic policy staffs have basically been saying for years, look, Mr. President, we've got a good story to tell here on jobs, on manufacturing jobs, on inequality, rising wages for poor people, on minority employment. We haven't talked about that at all, but the gap between black and white unemployment rates has gone down to a record low. Hispanics have also benefited from low unemployment. Even people with disabilities, the unemployment rate of people with disabilities has gone down a lot. That's all a very, positive story to tell, especially for a, progressive party. But the political people, I think, a lot of them just say, this just doesn't sell. You know, they just look at the polls and they say, look, Biden's approval rating on the economy, as you say, is 40%. So their advice has been, I think, to steer away from that if you can. You know, if you have to talk about the economy, talk about it. But let's emphasize other stuff like Trump as a threat to democracy. I think that sort of argument seemed to win out earlier in the year. And Biden was very much emphasizing the sort of non-economic arguments. But he seems to have flipped a bit in the last few weeks.
Earlier this week, Biden announced a new budget proposal that he says will cut the deficit by $3 trillion, mainly by increasing taxes on companies and on the wealthy. This was a big part of the State of the Union address as well, that corporations and billionaires shouldn't be paying less taxes than teachers and nurses. Can you explain how this proposal aligns with Biden's larger plan and the way in which this is him trying to draw a distinction between himself and Trump?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the individual policies go back to the Build Back Better plan, which, included a lot of these things. But I think going into election year, the White House is determined to draw a contrast between its policies and the Trump and the Republicans. So it's emphasizing higher taxes on the rich, both to finance more social programs, but also to reduce the deficit. And as you've said, and as I think I've said, some of these individual proposals are not new, they go back a long way. But I think what's new is if you put them all together, it actually does amount to a big sort of bold proposal to shift the tax burden back to the rich, which was shifted away from them in the 2017 Trump-Paul Ryan tax cut. So make that a big political issue. Make that a big point of contrast, because, of course, Trump is going to be out there saying he's for the working man. That's his whole shtick. The Biden strategy is to say, well, actually, he's not for the working man, he's for the billionaires. I'm the one who's going to tax the billionaires and, give new programs like preschool to the middle class. And I think, that's exactly the argument he should be making. Whether it will get through is obviously a political question, but I think it's a consistent and well-founded argument. You just have to look at the contrast between what Biden said the other night and what Trump's talking about, which is basically making permanent all the 2017 tax cuts for the rich and corporations and having blanket tariffs. That's his basic economic program, it seems. Permanent tax cuts for the rich plus blanket tariffs, which will raise the prices of all imports for everybody. I think that's a big potential weakness of Trump's plan politically. It's just a matter of whether Biden can sell it.
A recent CBS News poll shows voters remember the economy being better under Trump than under Biden. How would you compare their economic records?
Well, I mean, it's a story of pre-pandemic and post-pandemic.
Yeah.
Pre-pandemic, the economy was doing very well. It had already started to accelerate a bit under the end of the Obama administration, and then it did very well in the first 3 years of Trump as well. Unemployment rates were low. And job growth was strong. GDP growth was pretty strong as well. But then the pandemic hit and, we had the deepest recession since the 1930s. People have sort of forgot about that in 2020. But I think when a lot of voters look back, they look to the sort of 2018, 2019. But I also think because there was a big recession and a big surge in prices after that, they sort of have sort of rosy-tinted view of the previous era, and that's obviously an issue for the White House.
Do you think that if Biden can't get through to people on the economy that he'll likely lose the election? I mean, is that the main thing that you think people are going to be thinking about when they vote in November?
I wouldn't go quite that far. I mean, there's been a lot of arguments of political science made over the last sort of few years that economics doesn't matter as much as it used to do. I mean, the conventional wisdom, I've been reporting on elections since 1988, which is quite a while. And, until I would say 2016, the conventional wisdom was the Carville quote, you know, it's the economy, stupid.
Yeah.
Basically, presidential elections were referendums on the economy. What we've seen with the rise of Trump and subsequent pandemic is cultural issues and broader sort of class issues, trumping, to use the word, economic issues in a lot of cases. So, you know, you teach some political scientists and political strategists and they think the culture war is where it is what determines everything now and economics is secondary. As an economics reporter and as an economist myself, I obviously tend to emphasize economics. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, I think that's an ongoing debate about the relative importance of economics. I just think it still is the sort of primary factor, but, you know, it's a debate now.
Yeah, well, it's something I'll definitely have to ask you about as the election season goes on. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you. It was fun.
John Cassidy is a staff writer at The New Yorker. You can find his work at newyorker.com. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Julia Nutter and edited by Stephanie Karayuki, with production assistance from Jake Loomis and Mike Kutchman. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Enjoy your week, and we'll see you next Wednesday.